for today is to speak about the ecumenical apostolate, and tomorrow, the last day, I believe, on the liturgy. The ecumenical movement about which we've been hearing so much in recent years is actually part of a larger development that is taking place in the human race, and about which the late Pope John and the present Pope Paul have written and spoken a great deal. It is one of the main reasons for the convocation of the Second Vatican Council. The document, by the way, of Pope Paul VI, Ecclesiam Suam, is indispensable for a proper understanding of the whole complexus of the ecumenical movement. As we approach the subject, the word itself, ecumenical, is, we know, a fairly ancient term. It was applied from the very beginning to the general councils of the Church. Thus, Nicaea in 325 was called the Ecumenical Council. The word itself means worldwide. Its first use in Scripture, by the way, occurs in the Gospel text where our Lord speaks, "And what she has done for me will be said of her wherever the gospel is preached throughout the world." For the last 100 years, however, the word ecumenical has been appropriated by the Protestants, also by some Orthodox, to describe the promotion of Christian unity. This is still the sense that we most commonly use the term, and is the sense in which the decree on ecumenism mainly refers to the term. In its broadest concept, however, this ecumenical apostolate may be properly translated, as it is by Pope Paul, as the dialogue of salvation. Dialogue of salvation, whose foundation, he points out, is the cosmic dialogue of God with the human race. God, in becoming man, engaged in that dialogue with his creatures, without which all other dialogues would be impossible. But there are four particular kinds of interchange or intercommunication of spirit and ideals that properly fall within the ambit of the ecumenical movement in its broadest concept. First, within Catholicism, a dialogue between Catholics. Then within Christianity, between Catholics and other Christians. That, of course, is the most commonly kind of dialogue. Then outside of Christianity, between Catholics and those who belong to the non-Christian religions. Finally, outside of religious belief, between Catholics and those who do not even believe in God. All four types of dialogue or intercommunication are recognized as typical of the modern world. All four have been advocated by the Church. All should be known for us in the teaching profession. The dialogue within the Catholic Church. In a sense, all we've been talking about for the last 2 weeks has been an effort, at least one man who I suppose you might think was indulging in a monologue, really was intending to communicate ideas from people that I've met and over the years have been impressed by, and of course the Church herself and yourselves. But properly speaking, this dialogue within the Church is something that is crucially necessary in an age where success depends on cooperation, and where too often Catholics are not cooperating the way they should. What are some of the areas of lack of cooperation? Well, frankly, they cover the whole gamut of our Catholic life. As among the laity, between one parish and the other. I have in mind, for example, in Chicago, just on the outskirts of Oak Park, where I have been working with our provincial, is a fairly poor parish. Large families, lower middle class. Inside of Oak Park, wealthy suburb, one of the wealthiest parishes in the United States. I may have mentioned this in the conferences. Just the repair job on the church, $750,000. Yet you would think they belong to two different religions. Within 15-minute walk of each other, but almost no cooperation. The one parish let it struggle. The other parish, all the money it wants and more than it needs. Lack of cooperation between the clergy and the laity. Lack of communication between ourselves as religious and the laity we teach. Then between religious sisters, and the clergy. All kinds of room for dialogue. Then between the church at large and those in authority over the church. Grave problems of insubordination. The crisis of authority about which we've been talking is more than just a term or a phrase. It is a crucial thing, no doubt partly at least stimulated by the extreme freedom of the Second Vatican Council, where things have been called into question that were held sacred for centuries as infected, actually infected, not a small part of our Catholic people. Just last night, happened to page through a book that the chaplain bought at Chardon, written by a Catholic. From the first to the last page, a full-blown defense of contraception, as though the church had never spoken on the subject. All these areas, therefore, suggest the need for cooperation within the church. But there is one feature particularly that we ought to be aware of as pertinent to our own cooperation in the church. And that is that as often as we, for example, recite the creed and speak of the church as being one, as often as in teaching others, we tell them that one of the marks of the church's divinity is her unity, we may forget that the only kind of unity promised to the church by Christ is that substantial, essential unity which keeps the church in existence. But it depends on the degree of our cooperation with the grace we receive, notably of charity, that deepens and heightens this unity, which is one of the marks of the church. And that consequently, if this is one of the four marks of the church, which means this is one of the things by which the church is recognized, the less unified we are, the less that mark is evident to those who don't believe in us. And consequently, to that extent, is it any wonder that so many do not take the Catholic Church seriously? Among the means recommended, especially by Pope Paul, to foster unity, that is, greater unification within the Catholic Church, are surprisingly the exercise of authority by those who have it, of course, with faith, humility, and charity. So the first incumbent duty for those who are in authority to recognize that the people they are dealing with are not chattels in a religious community. They had vowed themselves voluntarily to submit to a human being for the love of God, and should be so treated, and in deep humility. Any sign of arrogance in a superior is devastating to unity, and above all, charity. then on the side of those who are in the church at large, willing obedience. The Pope has been insisting almost every week, some elocution, some speech somewhere, urging obedience to authority. Conscious more than, we can safely say, most Catholics, of the grave need of obedience from the bishops down to the lowliest laity towards the authority in the church. And let me stress, and let's pray for the obedience of bishops to the Holy See. What are some of the good results that may be hoped for from a deepening of unity or this dialogue within the Catholic Church? Again, surprisingly, all kinds of things we would expect to be the good fruit of this dialogue. But you know what the main reason given? It is that there will be a more effective communication of the teachings of Christ between those who are in the teaching position of the church and among the Catholics themselves. How seldom do we realize that when people are said to be united, after all, when you've got disparate entities, as all people are, Sister so-and-so is not Sister such-and-such, there is an edge beyond which, for example, I don't go. That's the edge of me. And that person's body is the beginning of him or her. We are all distinct physical entities. And consequently, whatever it is that will unite us is not something of flesh and blood. It must be something of spirit. Now, in terms of the dialogue, the intercommunication between spirit and spirit, which is what we are, in spite of external appearances to the contrary, we are spirits, spiritual beings, housed in a bit of clay. The intercommunication between spirit and spirit is the only thing that a spirit can communicate to another spirit, and that is something of itself. And what is that something? Some kind of idea. And even when we speak of communicating affection or charity, it can only be because we have said something which the person, rightly or wrongly, interpreted as a motive for charity. In other words, it is through the communication of ideas and specifically of the teachings of the gospel that the church looks for as a fruit or development of the dialogue inside of the church. With that as a background, the second dialogue deserves extensive treatment. In fact, I brought pages of text with me. In popular speech, and normally when found in writing, the ecumenical movement for most people means, although it is not that exclusively, a dialogue between Catholics and other Christians. In the United States, this is the crucial kind of dialogue, for the simple reason that most of the pluralism in the United States is as between Catholics and those who are not Catholic but Christian. In other countries, it is different. Take, for example, India, where whatever dialogue the Catholics are to engage in, it is only minimally with Protestants. Just a handful of Protestants in India. But millions, over 400 million, non-Christians. And therefore, the dialogue for them will be the next one coming up. Relevant to us, too, but for them, the third is more important. For us, the second. For the sake of convenience, I'm dividing my subject, surprisingly, into four areas, usually three. And they are knowledge, holiness, cooperation, and communication. Where knowledge has to do with understanding what ecumenism is, the kind we're talking about here. Holiness with becoming what ecumenism most needs: cooperation with working together with fellow Christians, and communication with striving to share the spiritual riches we possess. Understanding ecumenism. We may define the ecumenical movement with the Vatican Council, which I commend to your reading, and I quote, as the initiatives and activities planned and undertaken according to the various needs of the Church and its opportunities offer to promote Christian unity. The essence of ecumenism, then, is the promotion of Christian unity. And no one with a spark of faith, after a moment's reflection, would want anything but an end to this scandal of Christian division. 266, I believe, is the current number of Protestant denominations in the United States. What is less obvious is the exact meaning of disunity and the corresponding effort to change a divided Christianity. Clarity here is indispensable, and I mean indispensable. Sisters, as complacent as we are about this now, 10 years from now, see, this is the ecumenical era, unless we have our feet flat on the ground, ideas clear, people are going to be swept off their feet. This is a revolution, sisters, in case you don't know. And consequently, whatever success the movement will have in the Catholic Church depends, in the nature of things, in large measure on the clergy and religious, we being in the position of teaching and instructing others, knowing what we are being urged to promote and promoting others to promote, at the risk of falling into one of two extremes, both risky, both possible. Either taking ecumenism as just another fellowship program, let's get along, a kind of let's get along technique, which I've heard more than once, or thinking it means a concerted effort to convert people to Catholicism, a back to Mother Church crusade. I'm quoting my Protestant brethren. Unfortunately, some of the literature on the subject is not very helpful. And of course, I include Catholic literature. Enthusiasm is no substitute for theology. And zeal in any cause, even in the cause of Christ, should be founded on the solid rock of faith and balanced on the level ground of Catholic tradition. Otherwise, what offers such hope of benefit to souls may burn itself out before it gets a chance to set the Church aflame with an apostolic spirit that I think the world has not known since the first apostolic age. The change of heart, of attitude in the non-Catholic world is a moral miracle. It is part of the age which Pope John recognized and was one of the main reasons for his summoning the Council. Our best guide, obviously, is the Council itself in its teaching on what the ecumenical movement is to do and what are the basic principles on which those of us who are in the teaching business should base our own norms. Heading the list of these principles is the fact that two kinds of division among Christians are implied in the word disunity. The first and most serious, and one too seldom adverted to, is separation from unity with the Roman Catholic Church, which the Council describes by the use of such terms as separated brethren and outside the visible boundaries of the Catholic Church. The terms used by the Council show that our fellow Christians are conceived as not being professed members of the Catholic Church, and therefore are somehow separated from that union with the body of Christ, which the late Holy Father Pius XII identified as the Roman Catholic Church. In other words, Protestants are not Catholics. And if you think that's a platitude, you have not been doing much reading, sisters. There are Catholics, some highly placed Catholics, who are wondering whether the distinction should not be erased. Another division in Christendom is the variety of churches and denominations that are not professedly Catholic, and whose differences range across the whole gamut of doctrine, ritual, and moral precept. It was this kind of disunity, that is, among the Protestants themselves, that first gave rise to the ecumenical movement, and is still the main preoccupation of the World Council of Churches. While saying this, however, the Vatican Council is at pains to balance both types of division. It is not only that these people are separated from us and divided among themselves, but they have a union among themselves and with us that we have not sufficiently adverted to in centuries gone by. This alone is the heart of the ecumenical movement from the Catholic side. Those who are baptized, the Council says, and who profess belief in the Trinity and the divinity of Jesus Christ, are united both among themselves and with us by mystical bonds of grace which flows through everyone who is incorporated into Christ by baptism and belief in his sacred name. That we have not, I am sure, sufficiently adverted to. It happens that my doctoral dissertation in Rome was on this subject of the relationship of non-Catholic Christians to the mystical body. And I know what advances and developments have been made, even in that not too long a period since I got my doctorate. A second principle logically follows from the first. If disunity is undesirable, it can only be because of its effects, which the Council spells out in plain terms. Why is disunity, particularly from the Church, and of course consequently among themselves, why is it harmful? Why, in other words, bother removing this disunity? It is, the Council says, because it deprives those who are disunited from that fullness, and these are the crucial words, that fullness of participation in the means of salvation which are to be had in their entirety only in the Roman Catholic Church. All through the decree on ecumenism, the Catholic Church, quote, of which Peter is the head, is described as normative. The Catholic Church is the criterion, the standard, the norm of all the means of salvation. All other Christian bodies are approximations, so that where its full-fledged members enjoy access to the abundance of God's blessings, those not so privileged, through no fault of their own, have only part of that which we have in its fullness. Lastly, the third principle. At its center, the ecumenical movement is a coordinated effort to bridge the gap that still separates other churches than the Catholic from access to the plenitude of divine goodness that God became man to confer on the human race. Now here is a delicate point of demarcation. The ecumenical movement as such is not a convert movement. This must be clear. Not knowing this is to mistake the ecumenical movement, to harm it, and not to foster its purpose. The driving power of the ecumenical movement is not the terminal effect of bringing as many people as possible into the Catholic fold. That we leave to God. On a broader base, it seeks to reduce disunity among Christians by having them grow in the possession of a common faith, to believe more than they do, common worship, to use what they believe has been dictated by Christ in ritual and worship more and more, and a common acceptance of moral laws, which we believe are present in their fullness in Catholicism, but which, now here is the crux of it, which we, in the promotion of the ecumenical movement, believe whatever increase in faith, in worship, or in moral precept, they acquire, is all gain. And we do not, therefore, so dichotomize our dealings with our fellow Christians as to think of everything being black and white. Recognizing that God in his mysterious providence has allowed millions for centuries now not to be united with Catholic unity. Whatever assistance we can give them to have them grow even a little bit in their faith, in their use of the Christian rites, and in their acceptance of the Christian moral code, is pure gold. Here we touch, of course, on a secret of divine providence. Why is there such disunity, and has been from the dawn of Christianity? Already in the apostolic age, St. John, for example, wrote the Apocalypse, mainly on the basis of a revelation, in order to unite what was already becoming a dismembered Christian world over the centuries. Remember St. Michael's, Monsignor Chapel used to take us in church history in the 8th grade, and long before I knew what they meant, I knew all about the Monophysites, Monophysites, Eutychians, Nestorians, Arians, and the rest of them. Way before the tragedy either of the 11th century between the Orthodox and Rome, or the 16th, there had always been divisions. Why? We don't know the full reason, but one reason must be, in terms of that charity we talked about in a conference, God allows limitations, he allows inadequacies, he allows approximations, in order that those who recognize those limitations, those needs, might in some way strive to fill them. With that as a background of the principle, we come now to the practicalia of the ecumenical movement as between ourselves and mainly the Protestant world. We would expect the Vatican Council to cut through the trappings of a very complex subject and identify the heart of the ecumenical movement, I quote, "The heart of the ecumenical movement is a reformation of morals in the Catholic Church. And the only baffling thing is that so many people don't believe it. They don't believe that the Catholic Church is in need of a reformation from the inside." You think you've torn a page out of the history book. There can be no ecumenism, the Council says, without a change of heart. In whom? In us. A new term has been coined, spiritual ecumenism. The Council calls it the soul of the ecumenical movement. It consists in holiness of life achieved through reformation of conduct and assiduous prayer. It is no platitude to say that we have no more effective way. In fact, unless this is present, all other ways are surely ineffective for reuniting a dismembered Christian world than by professing our faith in deeds. And that includes every last one of us, priests and believers. One of the main causes of the Reformation was the conduct of clergy, immorality, simony, concubinage, from the popes to the bishops to the priests, of religious. It is no coincidence, and we should constantly remind ourselves, the Protestant Reformation was started by a religious, who, together with his rector, began the Protestant Reformation. And in less than a generation, emptied convents and monasteries. Or, as later happened, within 15 years of Wittenberg, where the monastery that Luther lived in had become the cell, or had become cells, for the now married religious men and women. And the laity, from the emperors down, they profess to be Catholic, but their Catholicism stank to the heavens. To reverse history, the opposite must be done. And that it should be taking 400 years for us to discover that if we're going to change what had originally occurred, we have got to do what our forebears did not do. We must show forth to the world the good fruits of the faith we believe in, and prove better than any verbal argument that the Sermon on the Mount is being lived out, as Christ would have it, by those who are Catholics, and for us who are religious, where the name religious is not a pseudonym. No amount of exposition, a library is being filled on this subject, on the ecumenical movement. It's all verbiage. None can take the place of this visible presence of God in the world. If our example be lacking, and sisters, our example is lacking, then the most convincing logic fails. In fact, it looks suspiciously hollow. If the gospel you preach, says the Protestant, how many times I've been told that in equivalent terms. If the gospel you preach is so effective in making people holy, why has it been wasted on you? We know this is simply a modern application of Christ's words to his followers. You are the light of the world, so let your light shine before men in order that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father in heaven. And the very isolation of religious institutes is partly, of course, a reaction to that devastating sea of immorality in the 16th century that the Church of God is bidding us not hide whatever virtues God has given to us under a bushel that make our presence and that virtue filled in a world that badly needs what God has given to us. As we mentioned before, and this is where the first type of dialogue is so essential for the second, because among the good works we perform to merit, and this is something we can only merit from God, reunification, none stands higher than unity among ourselves. If the world of apostolic times was drawn to Christ, mainly, we are told by the early fathers, by the evidence of mutual charity, canonized in the phrase, "See how Christians love one another," the same law of attraction still obtains today. And the reason, sisters, why millions are not in the Catholic Church is because we are not practicing charity the way we should. How blindly for 30 years we can keep repeating the phrase, "I have been uncharitable," forgetting, oblivious of the indispensability of this virtue to merit the grace that so many souls need and would get were we the Christians we should be. Of course, we should also pray for unity. In this, incidentally, we should not allow ourselves to be outstripped by those whom we still complacently call our separated brethren, often with an emphasis on the separated and the brethren in an undertone. They have been praying more than we for unity, obviously because they are part of this atomized Christianity. They are so painfully conscious of it, it hurts them, it pains them. They are praying and they ask us to join in their prayers. The second area of the ecumenical movement is mutual cooperation. Cooperation with non-Catholic Christians, most of us, I suppose, is a familiar spectacle. Aren't we living in a pluralistic United States? Don't Catholics and Protestants, well, consort in every possible profession and walk of life? Maybe they do, but most of that is pretty external. Very little really deep interchange of ideas. Nothing of this dialogue which the Church, under the aegis of both the Council and the present Pontiff, origin. Now we above all, sisters, we who are those who are to train the laity of the future, unless we come to understand how the other side of the Christian world lives, we cannot possibly expect those whom we train or teach to understand. Cooperation among the laity will be positively dangerous between Catholics and Protestants unless there is some kind of prior understanding born of cooperation which we ourselves have first somehow lived out. Now, sisters, if you don't know, I am making suggestions under the authority of the Church that are drastic, which may take years to implement. The need for us, priests and religious, to get to know and to get to know how to work with those whom, in most cases, we have hardly perhaps bothered even to greet. What has been the result of this exclusivism, and such it has been, between them and ourselves? We to ourselves, they to themselves. All kinds of ill effects have followed. I put the blame mainly for racism in America at the door of Christian leaders who, for more than 100 years, on both sides of the fence, Protestants and Catholics, and among us, priests and religious, have raised only weak voices against mass injustice to the Negroes, and until the last hour, he could hardly even agree on a common platform. When, for example, a large Midwestern diocese, not too many years ago, where the bishop had to instruct the clergy to go easy on converting the Negroes, because once they're converted, we don't know what to do with them. Moral and spiritual values in public education have been challenged by a rampant secularism that would remove every vestige of faith from the hearts of young Americans. It's an organized effort. Remember attending a three-day meeting with the American Council on Education in New York some years ago, and in a small committee in which I worked, one of the men, you may have heard the name Leo Pfeffer, he's published a number of books on church and state, he's appeared on TV any number of times, he is the counsel, the legal counsel, who has successfully defended before the Supreme Court some of the most destructive decisions in modern times. I'm speaking particularly of the prayer case of New Hyde Park, New York, and also the Bible reading case. As dedicated a secularist as you've ever met, 12 Catholics like him in the United States would change the face of our country. Burning zeal for 3 days, this is not in my notes, for 3 days at this meeting. We were paid handsomely, 60 of us from the United States were invited to attend the meeting. We were told to declare our expenses and, mind you, how much we would have earned during the 3 days plus travel that it took us to attend these meetings. And they sent us the check. A stenotypist typed for 10 hours during all the meetings, just pecking away at an electric typewriter. Every word was recorded and to be published. This one man, and in a way it's to his credit, his zeal, for almost 2 full days, his was about the only voice that was heard on that floor, except for the set speeches. He just talked endlessly and intelligently against any compromise of anything, mind you, anything religious, ever being taught in a public school classroom, and that man has successfully prosecuted several cases through the Supreme Court. What have we been doing, talking about it, as here, and I hope at least saying a Hail Mary? We have just not been united. We with our fellow Christians, who are more deeply concerned than we because we have our own bailiwick of our Catholic school system, which is in grave danger, sisters, unless we work with and improve the public schools. Cooperation between ourselves and those who are not Catholic but Christian, who are deeply concerned over the secularism in public life, particularly in public education. The breakdown of family life in the United States is the worst in our history, and historians say in the history of the human race. Nothing like it. Large cities have often one divorce to 2 marriages per year. And here again, one of the main reasons for this is, what shall we call it? The cowardice, the fear of Christian leaders cooperating among themselves, standing on a common front to stem this tide which will destroy the country more surely than communism. When was the last time, sisters, you working on missions have heard a really good sermon on the breakdown of family life? And if you go to Protestant pulpits, the same thing. Our crime rate is fantastic, and a growing number of criminals are young only in their teens, not in their crimes. Most of them are the product of broken homes. To save the family requires cooperation on a massive national scale. built on religious principles. Money won't do it. Unless we cooperate with families that are breaking down, Catholics with Protestants and vice versa, we shall both mutually destroy ourselves. Now, in dealing with people of other religious affiliations, clearly, I've got to know something about them. I cannot begin to cooperate unless I know whom I'm cooperating with. If, for example, I'm entertaining a Methodist minister and I serve him a highball, I don't know that Methodists are supposed to abstain from alcoholic beverages. Well, that's almost facetious. But the better I understand the common affirmations that we have, they as Protestants and I as a Catholic, the more confidently I can cooperate with these people. In all these matters, and many more we could mention, involving moral and religious values. Moreover, the more clearly I understand where we differ, the less likely I am to offend and lose a collaborator. It is impossible, you know, sisters, even in religious life in the community. If you don't understand a fellow sister, you will not be able to cooperate with her. From the first time you meet, there will be misunderstanding. Prior knowledge, therefore, is indispensable for the fostering of this second level of the ecumenical movement in terms of cooperation. Then communicating the faith. The Vatican Council, as we mentioned, we want to stress now, insists that ecumenism is not convert work. Nevertheless, though it is not convert work, we cannot lose sight of a very simple fact which some ecumenists are losing sight of. Some who have not inappropriately been called ecumeniacs. We cannot lose sight of the fact that one of the duties of a Christian is to give witness of his faith, not only by the example of a holy life, but by the teaching of the gospel and its communication to those who either don't have it at all or only partially. Of course, the ecumenical movement is not making converts. That's God's work. He's to give the grace. But it does not exclude, but emphatically includes, conversion of a very definite kind. If we mean by conversion only entrance into the Catholic Church, no, that's not the ecumenical movement. But if conversion means change of mind and heart, that I can effect in my fellow Christian by sharing with him my religious convictions in heaven's name, why talk? Why open my mouth? As St. Augustine says, the only reason why people talk or should talk is to say something, on the assumption that their listener does not yet know, does not yet have. And consequently, if the dialogue includes the dialectics of language, my sharing with him and he with me, it assumes then that I believe he does not have something which, by listening to me, he can increase or acquire. It is here where we, priests and religious, have got to take stock of ourselves. We mentioned this before, and here it comes into clearer focus. For too long, we have felt, I know we have, from the complacent way we talk about the laity, from the fact that we almost uniquely, the moment you hear vocation, the word itself, what does it evoke? Well, a call to our way of life. Well, those people are called too. from the way we talk about externals. Or sometimes, in some, I don't think it's in your constitutions, but some constitutions of some religious institutes speak of these people as strangers. An extern, of course, is only a Latinism for an outsider. What's outside about these people? Outside of what? We are all inside of the one mystical body. It means, then, that not just we, and that's the understatement of the 2 weeks, not just we, but all have a God-given right and duty to communicate the gospel. And consequently, one of the most incisive statements that has come from recent popes on this business of our recognizing the duty of the laity to communicate this faith is that of Pius XII, where he talks about isolationist Catholics who don't know what it means to be a Catholic. This passage I quoted at length. I'll read the paragraph and give you the reference. Pius XII. How many young people and adults who call themselves Catholic are satisfied to fulfill their immediate duties and meet the obligations strictly necessary for their own salvation? They betray how imperfect is their concept of the nature and demands of the Catholic religion. This religion is essentially apostolic. Pardon the Italian. Essentialmente apostolica. It would gain all souls for Christ, the humble and the mighty, the rich and poor, young and old. It would make the Lord known and loved always and above all. Whoever does not have this burning desire, this constant impulse to communicate the rich treasures of the faith to others, is not living up to what the Church expects of her children. The quotation is from the 17th volume of Discorsi and Radio Messaggi, page 454. Sisters, we have got to reassess our teaching apostolate to make it apostolic. Because we in the nature of things, being locked behind convent walls, and I mean locked, sisters, because I once in a while, for example, without identifying, in the evening wanted to get back to where I was supposed to be, but the doors were locked on me. It was late. The sisters had gone to bed. I had to find the night watchman. I found him. He was suspicious. He had never seen me before. He led me in through the kitchen door. I went upstairs, and he said, "I can't leave you alone here." Well, he left me alone. It was midnight. You know what he did? He got Mother General up. Said there was a strange man in the convent. He was so trained to make sure that nobody got inside of that convent. We are living a cloistered life. Convents must be locked. Let that not be symbolic of our ineffectiveness if we cannot go on to these millions who don't have our faith. At least let us be sure to train our laity from childhood on to communicate. From an ecumenical viewpoint, this desire to communicate covers the spectrum of what I possess of divine revelation. And of course, what I understand my separated brother in Christ does not have, I must be conscious of what he doesn't have and what I've got. It is not a question of selling him Catholicism. He becomes a Catholic, Lord bless him. But I tell him about what I believe, I share with him, I communicate. The most tongue-tied people in the world are Catholics. The shy, aloof, uncommunicative, those that Tied behind sisters' skirts and priests' cassocks are our Catholic laity, who have been told how many times by the non-Catholics, why don't they sometimes tell us what they believe? Why can they not give a better account of why they believe this is a God-given requisite of the ecumenic movement, which we cannot, in the nature of things, ourselves do all that we should like, but through the laity, we can enter the ecumenical arena as religious have never done before in the history of our respective communities. In the name of the Father.